in the world. In July, an anti-war group, Code Pink, warned that the proposed $25 billion hike in the Pentagon budget alone could end homelessness in the United States. The group accused lawmakers of trying to increase the profits of military contractors than meeting the needs of working class. The approved military spending bill also represents a bump from former President Donald Trump's last budget of $740 billion, which was then criticized by Biden's fellow Democrats. Upon entering the White House in January, President Biden pledged a massive overhaul of U.S. strategy toward the world to make it a better place. However, Biden continues to follow Trump's aggressive and warmongering policies, as the National Defense Authorization Act reflects that billions of dollars will go for the U.S. unending wars across the globe.
Hundreds of people demonstrated in Gaza City in solidarity with female Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails. Protesters marched towards the Legislative Council building while shouting slogans against Israel and expressing their unwavering support for the prisoners. In recent weeks, Israeli forces increased their attacks against Palestinian female prisoners. The issue of female Palestinian prisoners is highly emotive to all Palestinians. The protest was organized by the Al-Ahrar movement.
Palestinian female prisoners are being attacked inside Israeli prisons, and we will not remain silent. Attacking female prisoners is an attack on the honor of all Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims. They were beaten and their ribs were broken by the prison guards. We stand by the prisoners and we will spare no effort to secure their release from Zionist jails.
Palestinians believe that Israel can only be forced into releasing Palestinian inmates under prisoner swap deals. In late 2011, Hamas and the Israeli regime signed a prisoner swap deal under which Israeli soldier Yigal Shalit was released in exchange for over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the issue of Palestinian female prisoners is a red line that must not be crossed at any given time. Attacking and humiliating Palestinian female prisoners will not go unpunished. The Israeli regime will have to face all the consequences of attacking the female prisoners. As we stand here today, we say to all Palestinian prisoners that the resistance factions will always support them and that we will soon liberate them from Zionist jails.
Palestinian prisoners, including females, are kept in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers and are being subjected to torture and psychological pressures by Israeli prison authorities.
The Zionist regime is trying to commit genocide against Palestinian prisoners amid the silence and normalization of Arab regimes. We call on all Muslims to stand by Palestinian prisoners because Palestinian prisoners are fighting for a just cause. We have also sent a strong warning to the Zionist enemy over the issue of female Palestinian prisoners.
According to legal experts, the Israeli regime has long regarded itself above international laws and norms due to the protection it enjoys from some countries like the United States.
People here are demanding international action to support Palestinian prisoners' struggle for freedom. Israel currently incarcerates some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners, including scores of women and children. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
The Saudi war on Yemen has been ongoing for more than 7 years now. Far from home, Yemeni students in Iran gathered in Tehran to commemorate the victims of the war.
We Yemeni students have gathered here today to once again shed light on Saudi Arabia's crimes in our country. Saudi Arabia is bombarding innocent children and women in our country. Why is the UN keeping mum? Where is the Human Rights Watch? Aren't we considered human?
Saudi Arabia launched the war on Yemen in March 2015. With the goal of bringing former Yemeni President Abdurrabbuh Mansour Hadi back to power. The Yemeni army and its allied forces are leading the anti-Saudi resistance in the country. They say while Saudi Arabia is enjoying all-out support from its Western allies in its war, Yemeni forces have made headways against the invaders, turning the devastating war into a costly quagmire for Riyadh.
Saudi Arabia has failed to achieve its goals in our country. We have resisted for more than 7 years and shifted the balance in our favor. despite the use of American and British arms, Riyadh will never be able to impose its will on our nation.
The ongoing bombardment of civilian facilities has left tens of thousands of Yemenis dead and destroyed the infrastructure of the impoverished country. Not to mention the spread of infectious diseases and famine, Saudi Arabia has also imposed an all-out blockade against Yemen.
The Saudi war on Yemen is condemned here as a crime against humanity, a crime that continues to be ignored by the responsible entities in the world. Yemeni students here say this means it's up to the Yemeni people to take the matter into their own hands and continue their resistance until the country is finally free. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
With France's presidential election just 4 months away, Europe's largest Muslim community is being scapegoated and targeted by government repression as badly as ever. Almost 100 mosques have recently been raided by the government, with at least two dozen shut down so far. Earlier this year, a so-called anti-separatist law was accused of basically legalizing Islamophobia, as it tried to ban the hijab for minors and force the closure of not just mosques, but highly respected Muslim NGOs such as the Collective Against French Islamophobia. The latest assault on freedom of religion for French Muslims has been sharply criticized by foreign leaders and top NGOs.
France is a republic which claims to be very attached to the idea that the state must be neutral towards all religions. But the past year has seen an incredibly tough interference and meddling in the Muslim community. They're entering mosques and telling religious leaders to say this and to not say that. And this reflects the shift to the extreme right of President Emmanuel Macron's government.
The dominant theme of France's entire presidential election has shifted to the extreme right, as convicted racist Eric Zemmour has provided coronavirus-era France with almost nightly Islamophobic diatribes. Zemmour has rocketed to third place in the polls, giving Macron and other candidates license to blame Muslims for France's economic and political problems.
Zemmour resembles Donald Trump of the United States in that both thrive on outrage, but there are significant differences. Zemmour's entire career has been based around trying to be a part of the political scene and conversation, and he has benefited from support from major parts of the French establishment the entire time.
Il est invité dans tous les plateaux.
Zemmour is invited onto all the television news programs, even though he's a political pyromaniac who is trying to rehabilitate the era of Vichy France, when France collaborated with the German Nazis. He's very dangerous for all of France, and not just France's Muslims, because he's appealing to those who sympathize with the era of French colonial barbarism.
Ever since the Great Recession began, France's political and media elite have stigmatized Muslims to a degree which has gutted the nation's claim to be a global leader in freedom of religion, thought, and speech. The three most popular candidates in the presidential election all seem to be trying to outdo each other in Islamophobia, which has France's Muslims expecting the state-sponsored racism to be even worse over the next 4 months. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Iran's lead delegate to the Vienna talks says the eighth round of negotiations aimed at restoring the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action will be focusing on the two issues of verification and guarantees.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has announced that if an agreement is reached, the side that violated the deal, meaning the U.S., should remove the sanctions first. Iran should verify the removal of sanctions and only then take measures within the framework of the JCPOA.
Ali Bagheri-Kani says the U.S., which withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018 under the administration of Donald Trump, also needs to provide guarantees it will not withdraw again or impose sanctions in violation of the deal.
Iran's rightful and logical demand has been getting guarantees from the other side, and this, as well as the issue of verification, have in principle been accepted by them. But discussions need to take place on the mechanism, frameworks and criteria involved in order to reach a framework for an agreement.
Bagheri said the sides are set to discuss banking and financial sanctions in the coming days. Meanwhile, EU coordinator Enrique Mora says the talks need to end within a reasonable period of time, which, according to him, should be a matter of weeks rather than months. Mora said difficult political decisions need to be made, both in Tehran and Washington. Iran says if the other side shows it's ready to effectively remove sanctions and give the necessary guarantees, the talks can conclude successfully. Talks will continue at the level of experts and deputy foreign ministers in the coming days as efforts intensify to make the challenging prospect of a restored JCPOA a reality. Homolezgi, Vienna.
A meeting was held here in Western Kabul to bring the Islamic Emirate and the people closer together. The meeting was organized by a Shia association to pave the way for national solidarity in Afghanistan. During the meeting, the religious leaders and the Taliban officials stressed the need for mutual trust between people and the government.
One of the main responsibilities of the ruling group is nation building. Afghan nation is mainly composed of our Shia and Sunni brothers. We are part of United Ummah of Islam. In order to have a united Afghanistan, we should trust each other and rely on mutual values. The new government needs to represent all sections and ethnicities of Afghanistan.
Conspiracy is one of US and the Soviet Union's main heritages in our country. They destroyed the soil with it. The Islamic Emirate need to find a way for creating unity in Afghanistan. We are all Muslims, and we believe in God. Anyone who lives in Afghanistan is entitled to live in peace and play their role in the reconstruction of the country.
The religious leaders warn against foreign interference in Afghanistan and stress the urgency to get united.
The only thing that our country needs is peace and unity. We should build trust and get united. We must distinguish between our friends and enemies.
After taking power in August, the Taliban leaders have repeatedly held talks with the Shia community, seeking their support and allegiance. Shia Afghans support an Islamic government, but believe it must be an inclusive one. They want to see people in power who make Afghanistan a safe place for all. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Since Modi has taken over the country in 2014 as prime minister, India has turned from an ethnically diverse society to one of less tolerant and increased violence. But why? What's the goal? Stay with us on this Spotlight.
Panic is on the rise among minorities, particularly Muslims in India. While one can be arrested, threatened, or intimidated for even criticizing the majority, threats against the minorities with vicious hate speeches and ferocious social media campaigns hardly face the course of law. In recent weeks, several far-right groups with ties to the ruling party have called for ethnic cleansing of minorities, especially the country's Muslims.
Slowly, they are moving towards their target. That is to make India the fascist country. Unfortunately, the secular parties in India, they are weak, they are not united, they don't pose any challenge to the Hindutva element.
A three-day religious event, which was held in the northern Indian city of Hyderabad from 17 to 19 December, faced a tremendous backlash on social and political domains. The event witnessed a dramatic quantity of hate speeches, mobilization threats, and violence against Muslims. Local media reports say some ruling party members also attended the event. Critics say these groups are operating and functioning with a strong political patronage.
Government is trying an agenda which imposed on the Hindutva. They are trying to turn this country into the Hindutva country. And we will never ever allow this government to turn into the Hindutva. We will fight for this democratic right.
They are picking such issues intentionally during elections, and Muslims have always been soft target. Sometimes it's the eating habits of Muslims, sometimes their religious affairs.
While Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi boasts about democracy in India, critics accuse the ruling party of failing to stop violence against the minorities. Since the emergence of ruling BJP in 2014, anti-Muslim sentiments have been on the rise. A police case has been registered to investigate the matter, but there is no arrest yet. Rights activists say there is a less chance of any action by the administration considering the earlier incidents. They say if not addressed in accordance with the rule of the law, it could tear apart social harmony in a diverse country like India, which has a remarkable history of communal violence. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight. Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto. And the Chairman of Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajere, out of Qeshm.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome both of you to the program. Well, I'd like to start this off with Zafar. Thanks so much again for being with us. Do you think that the ruling party, BJP party, is specifically targeting Muslims? And if so, why would that be the case?
Absolutely. The ruling party's origins, and particularly those of Narendra Modi, are from a group called the RSS, Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh. It's a fascist outfit. It has more than 6 million members, and their avowed aim is to turn India into an exclusivist Hindu society in which there is absolutely no room for other religious minorities, be they the 200 million Muslims or millions of Christians or even Dalits that constitute something like 200 million people. Basically, the BJP, the ruling party, operates at two levels. Number one, by polarizing the population, it believes that it can garner the support of the Hindu majority, which of course it is doing. But at the same time, it is beholden to these extremist groups that want to turn India into an exclusivist Hindu state, in which there is no room for minorities, and that is also being pursued. If we look at the record of Modi since he became the Prime Minister in 2014, we see an alarming rise in anti-Muslim attacks in all parts of India, particularly around Delhi, places like Gurgaon and other places. Muslims are not given permission to build mosques. They are being targeted either because there are cow vigilantes who accuse Muslims of slaughtering cows, which is considered a sacred animal in India, or even accusing Muslim vendors, small vendors, of installing their push carts on roadsides, accusing them of blocking traffic when in fact there are no such allegations or accusations made against Hindus. So there are two aspects to this whole campaign. Number one, that Modi and his henchmen have found that polarizing the society garners them support in India because it's a majority Hindu country anyway, and therefore they don't care for the other people. It's not in that sense a true democracy. And number two, there is a very, very strong and dangerous movement in India that wants to turn India into a Hindu state.
Okay.
And that movement is actually supported by the ruling party, and that's the frightening part of it.
All right. Well, Masoud, your take. You heard what Zafar said. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling to think of this country with the size of it, and we're talking about Muslim population over 200 million. If that is the case, if actually Modi or BJP, they really want to turn us into a Hindu nation, I mean, what does that mean? How do they think that that can be accomplished, just looking at the sheer numbers?
It's very dangerous. I'm afraid this has been going on for quite a long time. It's going back even sort of before the sort of the new government being sworn in. I mean, in Gujarat, we had under governorship of Modi sort of ethnic cleansing and clashes and massacres of Muslims, which never dealt with appropriately, neither internationally or nationally within India. And this sort of Hindutva sort of movement, which is pushing the idea of otherization and sort of concentrating on demonizing anyone who is not Hindu, it's getting strength. And unfortunately, I have to say that it's out of control. We are not just it, which is been going on and has been going on for a very long time, but we are actually seeing legislation after legislation discriminating against the Muslims in India on censorship and on even saying that any religious group could actually, from the neighboring country, could go to India and get sanctuary, except Muslims.
Right.
And so this exceptionalization against Muslims is going on, and I think international community, and indeed even the Muslim nations, are completely silent to this demonization. And even there are a number of token Muslim leaders who's actually part of BJP and promoting this. And also, just to throw in the situation of Kashmir, which is part of that sort of demonization of Muslims, right, and denying them the right, is again very obvious and very clear. Something needs to be done,
okay,
on a matter of urgency.
Well, what about that, Zafar? Masood said that something needs to be done. I want to look at starting inside of the country itself. I mean, India likes to call itself the largest democracy in the world. How did this legislation, for example, the citizenship law, actually pass? I mean, in a country that says it's democratic, and then has this very extremist elements that is growing. Tell me about the inside of the country and how this is allowed to happen.
Well, basically what the BJP is doing is, as you pointed out, that it is enacting laws through parliament, because the BJP has a majority in parliament, and this national citizenship law, which they have passed, which basically disenfranchises Muslims, and they can be essentially thrown out of the country. In fact, these are moves going on right now in India, in certain parts of India, that they are enacting. Then there are other aspects. In fact, the Indian constitution, for instance, says that all citizens have equal rights. But as far as the BJP is concerned, it does not believe in this. One of the BJP's leaders, Subramaniam Swamy, was being interviewed by Britain's Channel 4, and she asked him directly and said that your constitution says that all citizens have equal rights, so why are Muslims being persecuted? And Subramaniam Swamy openly said that we do not consider Muslims to be equal to Hindus, and therefore they cannot have equal rights. When you look at this situation, this is absolutely frightening, that they are actually instituting laws to discriminate against Muslims and to consider them as being alien to that country. In fact, these Hindu extremist groups have made absolutely no secret of the fact that the Muslims must either convert to Hinduism or they have to be killed, as this recent meeting of December 17th to 19th that took place in Haridwar in India, and they categorically stated that we need to arm ourselves, that we need to start to kill Muslims, and we need to eliminate these Muslims. And when you look at the fact that Narendra Modi hasn't even uttered a word of condemnation of this, speaks volumes that he is actually encouraging and supporting this kind of attitude and behavior. And I'm afraid if serious action is not taken, First of all, by Muslim countries. Secondly, by the larger international community. I am afraid that there is going to be a genocide of Muslims in India on such a horrendous scale that will boggle the mind. And I'm afraid this is where it is heading unless immediate action is taken.
Well, let's look at the international aspect to this, Masood. Do you see any action coming from the international community or Muslim communities you talked about earlier that there is not enough being done? What is being done and what do you think should be done?
Well, really, nothing positive has been done. I mean, we have seen that some of these Persian Gulf countries like Bahrain and others have actually awarded Modi with the highest award and recognition. It's outrageous that this is happening at the time that so openly, so publicly, so institutionally, Muslims are being demonized and to the extent that the slaughtering of them, it is really becoming very obvious that if nothing is happening, then we are going to see ethnic cleansing and genocide against Muslims. And let us remember that this is going long way back. I mean, colonial power, Britain in particular, were involved in this divide and rule policy, which actually has already once resulted in genocide of hundreds and millions of people in India in the partition time. And now this new ideology and Hindutva is an ideology which is fixed on ethnic cleansing, fixed on supremacy, and fixed on promoting this. And, it's being promoted systematically. Their supporters, United States, are becoming powerful and locked by. And so I can't see anything is going to happen automatically. We need to bring awareness. And, India is going down a route which I think genocide and ethnic cleansing is just around the corner. Hmm. And I'm not being alarmist. This is actually what is happening. And even the Muslim world and countries are absolutely in daydreaming while this is taking place.
Well, Zafar, we know that India has been getting closer and closer to the Zionist regime, Israel. I mean, when hearing some of the things that you were saying and also Masood was saying, it was like out of the Israeli playbook, some of the issues that the Muslims are facing now in India. Your assessment of that, do you see any similarities to what is taking place and perhaps Israeli influence in this, or your assessment of that side of things?
Oh, absolutely. The Indian fascists, the Hindutva fascists, are actually following the Israeli model completely. What the Zionists are doing to the Palestinian people in Palestine, this is precisely what these Hindutva fascists are doing to Muslims in India, except that the scale is much larger in India, because in India we have at least 200 million Muslims. I would echo exactly what Masood said, that these anti-Muslim pogroms and riots have been going on since day one of the creation of India. But since the BJP came to power, it has escalated alarmingly, because these fascist groups now have a state at their disposal. And let me give you some examples. For instance, the police force in India, in most parts of India, are infested by these Hindutva fascists. So when Muslims are being targeted, even if they go to lodge a complaint, the police don't pay any attention. You look at the latest example that happened on December 17th to 19th, when a complaint was lodged, although evidence was presented to the police that look at these Hindu fascists that are openly declaring that they should arm themselves and perpetrate a genocide against the Muslims, only one person has been charged out of an entire group of thousands that were involved in that. That gives you an indication of the level of infiltration that has taken place of these fascist elements. The same thing applies to the bureaucracy in India. You go everywhere and you see that today Muslims are first of all deprived of their economic rights. Now they're being deprived of their political rights, and they're actually being killed, and very little is being done inside India. So we see that the playbook that the Zionists are following in Palestine, in occupied Palestine, is being repeated in India. I want to add one other point, and that is that India is now considered an ally of the United States and of the West in general, because they want to target China and they want to rope in India on their side. In the United States, there is an organization called the United States Commission for International Religious Freedom. For 2 years in a row, 2020 and 2021, this organization called upon the U.S. State Department to say that India is a country of concern because of religious persecution of minorities, and the State Department should put it on its list. For 2 years in a row, the State Department has categorically refused to do so, claiming and stating that just because India is an ally, that we would not do such a thing. So I'm afraid we are facing a very, very serious situation whereby, regrettably, neither the Muslim countries nor the broader international community is going to do anything about it. And that is why I said that there is a very, very serious risk of a genocide of Muslims taking place in India.
A message you had mentioned, Kashmir, earlier, and again, when I talk about that comparison between what the Israeli regime is doing, and we look at what Kashmir, that situation, and how at one point in time they were able to keep their land and just other Muslims from the region could, but now Modi, with the law that was passed, actually allows anyone to go in there, and we see an unbelievable crackdown on Kashmir. My question is, do you think there is going to be blowback for all of this inside of India from what is being done in Kashmir, from what is being done inside of India to the minority communities in general, as Zafar had pointed out? The Muslims are 200 million. There are also Christians and others. Do you think that we're going to see some type of reaction from within India, or does pressure have to come from outside?
I think the pressure has to come from outside and inside the combined. The reality is that they have, I mean, as I mentioned, Gujarat massacre was a sort of an exercise to see if they could get away with it. It happened at the time that they weren't in absolute power, but nevertheless, with all the evidence which was there, and we presented an extensive report on it from IHRC, but nothing was done. They got away with it. They're getting away with it in Kashmir, and they're getting away with all these demonization publicly from very high up within the Indian society. They're getting away with it. That is really what makes it very clear that, you know, we are at a very, very dangerous sort of time. Something needs to be done urgently, internationally and nationally. And I'm afraid we can't hold our breath and wait for the OIC to do anything. They've never done anything for anyone. But I think we need to sort of expose what is happening is going to be creating one of the greatest sort of genocide, which, you know, which has taken place. And until unless something will be done urgently, and I emphasize urgently, then we are well already in the way of that genocide, and all the preparation for it, all the tests, and all the you know, the situation of Kashmir and the change of the laws against the constitution and so forth, they're all in place for this fascist system to go into the full scale and create that sort of genocide. And we need to really ring the alarm bells all over and ring it in such a way that this sort of genocide, that level in a place like India, is going to be so devastating, not just for Indian Muslims, but for everyone in the region and beyond.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me here on the Spotlight. Zafar Bangash, from the Institute, Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought out of Toronto, and out of Qesh, lucky you, Masood Shahjadeh, Chairman of Islamic Human Rights Commission. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, last week we completed explanation of Surah Zariyat. And from this Friday onwards, we embark on explanation of the next surah, that is Surah Tur, which is number 52 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It was revealed in Mecca and has 49 ayahs. The surah derives its name from Tur, or the mount. More specifically, the Mount of Sinai, on which God Almighty revealed the Torah to Prophet Moses. The surah thus opens with the divine oath by the Mount Sinai to signify its sacredness. It addresses many of the arguments put forth by the pagan Arabs of Mecca to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The torment of hell for the disbelievers is contrasted by the bliss of paradise for the true believers. The prophet is commanded by God to continue delivering the universal message of Islam in the face of the opposition by the disbelievers and to await divine judgment, which is inevitable. According to a hadith from the Prophet, the one who recites Surah Tur shall be safe from torment and shall enjoy divine favors in paradise. Now we present you the first four ayahs of this surah.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wat-tur wa kitabim masfur fi raqqin manshur والبيت المعمور.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. By the Mount Sinai, by the book inscribed on an unrolled parchment, by the house greatly frequented. The surah begins with several oaths, and in these first four ayahs, three divine oaths are mentioned. The first two divine oaths refer to Tur or Mount Sinai, and the divine book, which according to exegetes, is the one inscribed and preserved in Lohe Mahfuz, or the secure tablet in the celestial heavens, in an unrolled state and revealed to the last and greatest prophet as a universal message for the guidance of mankind in all ages. The third divine oath by the Baitul Ma'mur, or the much frequented house, according to exegetes, is the holy Kaaba in Mecca, which is always thronged by pilgrims, and more specifically the edifice in the celestial heavens for the worship of angels that can neither be desecrated by anyone nor deserted due to pandemics and strife as it happens on earth. According to the Prophet's vicegerent and first infallible successor, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, the Baitul Ma'mur, or greatly frequented house in the heavens, is visited all the while by thousands of angels who circumambulate, pray, and then never come back again. In other words, it implies constant increase in the realm of creation. These ayahs teach us that, number one, oath on the symbols of sacredness, including a book, and that too amongst both the ignorant and those claiming to be masters of speech, indicates the high value Islam attaches to writing and reading. Number two, it is incumbent upon believers to keep alive the glorious heritage of the prophets and their endeavors in enlightening humanity. And number three, the heavenly scripture revealed for the guidance of all mankind should be written in clear format on the best material and published in abundance to ensure proper distribution so that people have easy access to it. Now we invite you to listen to ayahs 5, 6, 7 and 8 of the same surah.
والسقف المرفوع والبحر المسجور إن عذاب ربك لواقع ما له من دافع.
By the elevated roof, that is the sky, by the surging or blazing ocean, indeed your Lord's punishment will surely befall. There is none who can avert it. In continuation of the previous ayahs regarding oaths by the divine signs, ayahs 5 and 6 take oath by two important factors of the world of creation. The first, the elevated roof, is reference to the sky or the canopy of heaven, to whose height or sublimity no limit can be assigned by the mind of man, which is unable to discover its mysteries despite advancement of science. The second divine oath by the Bahrul Masjur is a reference to the brimming, abounding, and agitated ocean where magma erupts through undersea volcanoes, and which would be set ablaze on the Resurrection Day. Ayahs 7 and 8 refer to the divine punishment on the Day of Judgment that will surely afflict those who die in the state of disbelief, denial, and sins. There is no escape from divine wrath, and none can avert it. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, by contemplating on the divine signs which are manifest in the universe, we get a glimpse of the infinite power of the Almighty Creator and His resurrecting of mankind on the Day of Judgment for rewards or punishment. And number two, the agonies one goes through during mortal life in our transient world are temporary and could be averted. While the punishment on the Day of Judgment for those who die in the state of disbelief, denial of truth, and unrepentant sins, despite the long respite given by the all-merciful Lord, will be severe and inevitable. Now we invite you to listen to ayahs 9, 10, 11, and 12 of Surah Tur in conclusion of this week's episode.
يَوْمَ تَمُورُ السَّمَاءُ مَوْرًا وَتَسِيرُ الْجِبَالُ سَيْرًا فَوَيْلٌ يَوْمَئِذٍ لِلْمُكَذِّبِينَ الَّذِينَ هُمْ فِي خَوْضٍ يَلْعَبُونَ.
On the day when the sky reels violently and the mountains move with an awful motion, woe to the deniers on that day, those who play around in vain talk. These ayahs point to the situation of the earth and the sky on the threshold of resurrection, when the world of existence that has been created for the best of creation, that is, mankind, shall come to its end, along with the end of the worldly affairs of the human race. In other words, the material world shall be rolled up through a terrible shaking of the sky and the earth, when the seemingly mighty mountains move from their places as powerful earthquakes occur. It means the material world shall disintegrate upon divine will and change into the hereafter. Divine torment in store for those who deserve it is based upon order and justice. As is clear from ayahs 11 and 12, the day of reckoning will be a day of woe to the disbelievers who belied the signs of Allah, since every evil deed has its own retributive and punishable chain of consequences. Whatever is done in the transient life of the mortal world is a preparation for the hereafter, which the disbelievers will find a reality on the Day of Judgment, which they used to deny and mock by indulging in vain talk and sins, despite the warnings of the long line of prophets sent by God for guidance. As for the true believers, it will be a day of joy and bliss. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, the massive upheaval of the material world will be the precursor for emergence of a new order for resurrection and the Day of Judgment. Number two, The deniers of the hereafter will find how irrational and baseless were their claims. But there is no repentance on that day. And number three, everything is based on justice by the all-merciful Lord who never wrongs anyone.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.